It came around after the Trump election, so it's actually a fairly new group. But there's been so much interest that there's already 1,500 members around the country. And the impetus, of course, was the election and the role that sort of misinformation and manipulation of data played in the election.
And so talk about some of the data that you dig into, and particularly as a local chapter.
We're working with Julia Richman, who's our city's chief analytics officer, on a few different projects that the city just has waiting. Like, one is we're looking at who tends to come to city council meetings and who emails the city council, like by neighborhood. We're looking at the air, water, gas project based out of CU, and we're sort of helping them take this huge trove of regulatory disclosures at the state level and digitize them.
You did say that this project really was formed in reaction to the Trump election, and there was so much misinformation put out there. It's not a new thing, though, that we're seeing faulty data or policy being made without any data. So talk a little bit about the importance of having actual data when we're making policy decisions, you know, across the board on a variety of different issues.
Well, with this open policing data that Stanford released that we'll be talking about in a moment, there's been so much national debate around about police violence, and it's, you know, it's a searing issue. And I think having data to back up what the people most vulnerable and hurt by police actions are saying is extremely powerful in, like, actually moving legislative action.
We're living in a political climate now where the administration in charge seems to be embracing the complete opposite reality of where you guys are coming from, looking at facts, looking at data, and looking at the actual truth. We're hearing terms put out from the administration like alternative facts. For folks like yourselves, granted you're volunteers as part of this, but you are coming from this as, you know, data analysts. I mean, what are the implications for our society when we have politicians and, you know, the highest office in the land completely rejecting facts, truth, science, and data?
Well, you have policy that's completely driven by people's previous standing biases. If you go into a problem thinking you already know what the solution is, and you don't look at the data, if you don't look at what the actual facts are, what the truth is, then you're going to have policies that are just going to be aligned with you, whatever biases you had when you tried to start solving the problem. And that's not actually solving any problems. They might be imagined problems or your own personal problems, but they might not be national problems.
Well, let's look at one of the data sets that you guys have been digging into. It's a national data set, but you've been really trying to get to grips with the local implications of this. And this was the Stanford Open Policing data set.
So Stanford looked at over 60 million stops by state police across the nation, and looked at the reasons for those stops, the outcomes of those stops, and in particular, the race of the driver in those cases. And they were able to look at national trends and find that overall there were disturbing implications of racial bias as far as the outcomes of these stops were concerned.
You, as the local chapter of Data for Democracy, drilled into that a little bit to look at what was happening here locally. Sam, what did you find?
Well, we took we tried to replicate their method as closely as possible, sort of at the local level. And just to be clear, we're not really doing that much original research. We're just verifying that the patterns they found nationally exist in the Boulder and Denver areas. And so they took two different approaches. One was they looked at the stop outcomes, whether you got a ticket or whether you got arrested from being stopped. And also they looked at how frequently searches were conducted and how frequently searches found contraband. And in all three of those categories, we found the same disparities locally as nationally, especially against Latino, the local Latino population.
You've created several graphs around this data analysis that you've done around police stops, you know, by race here in Colorado. And we'll link to those at news.kgnu.org. We'll have those graphs up there. What were the different areas that you looked at?
So I looked at the four most common reasons for the stop, and those were speeding, lights, unsafe movement, and registration or plates. And the reason I did that is it seemed most sensible if I was going to normalize by anything, then you would normalize by the reason you're pulling somebody over. And if you still tend to see harsher punishment for one race over another, even though you have the same reason for pulling them over, then I think that is something to investigate.
The whole, you know, premise of what you guys do is looking at data and how it can help inform us and what's happening right now. What kind of data are the police required to, or are they actually collecting? Because are we actually having them report or gather the data that's really needed to get a full view of what's happening here?
That's an excellent question, because what we found is the data is not extremely consistent. A lot of the areas a lot of the categories that we're interested in analyzing are not always filled out necessarily. You have different kind of you have more sparse data in some entries than other entries, and more disturbingly, data for the last 4 years or so is just missing. And so we've only been able to look at data from 2010 to 2014.
So were there trends then within that four-year period that you were looking at, either an increase or a leveling off? Or what trends did you see then over that four-year period?
So one thing that we didn't look at in particular, but that the Stanford team published about, is since marijuana was legalized in 2012, the searches actually dropped in half in Colorado and in Washington State when it was legalized. It turns out that the biases still existed to the same extent proportionally, but the searches were much fewer, which fortunately leads to less adverse outcomes for people of color.
So overall, less traffic stops. However, the proportion remains the same in terms of that bias of who
exactly is
being stopped.
Exactly. Latino folk are stopped twice as often as white folk, and contraband is found on them 30% to 50% less often. So you can't justify stopping a population more frequently if you're finding contraband on them less frequently. And until this data was released, this was only like a hunch from a very obvious hunch to people who are affected by it, but a hunch nevertheless.
Yeah, this is true. This is not going to be news from people in these communities who everyday reality is being stopped by
exactly
the police. What do you hope that your analysis of this data set and how it pertains to what's happening in Colorado, where do you hope it will go and what do you hope will happen from it?
Part of what I was surprised by the news coverage of the Stanford project was that aside from an analysis they themselves did of Oakland, local news outlets around the country haven't been picking this up as like an interest story for their area. So I'm hoping that we can kick something off where cities around the country all look at this data for their area and confirm what the problem is.
In terms of that, and when news outlets either do or don't pick up these type of research projects, that also seems to be tied into this whole trend that we're seeing, where we're seeing lack of investigative reporting, a lack of investment in that type of reporting, more editorializing happening that's masked as news. I mean, do you see this then all very much related? When you have, say, research institutions like Stanford putting a lot of data out there, but then we're not necessarily seeing the expertise maybe or the interest on the media side to present that then to the public.
Yeah, when you combine that with what you said earlier about how the new administration doesn't care very much about data, it's a very scary two-pronged attack on our institutions of like public knowledge and what we consider to be truth.
Also, if we look at what's happening here in Colorado, where you said that the police stops were disproportionately impacting the Latino community, and yet when searches were done and contraband was found, it was much less contraband found in the Latino community. Mm-hmm. Now we're also in a political reality where many people in the Latino community are very scared of any interaction with authority because of the increased presence of immigration officials and increased people being grabbed in courts and deportations happening. I mean, this has very real implications beyond just that physical reality of being stopped by the police.
Yeah. That's another data, like attribute of the data that we wish was collected that isn't. We don't know whether these stops result in immigration enforcement outcomes, but that would be really good to know.
Jeffrey, what are some of the takeaways that you want people to have from this? And just this overall concept of racial disparities in police stops.
I want people to take away is that even if you think your community is exceptional or beyond the pale. You need to look at local trends and see whether or not these biases exist. They can exist unconsciously in some, and it can exist overtly in other cases. But unless we have the courage to face it and see what the data says, then you can't ever solve the problem.
So given now that you have done an analysis of this using the data collected part of the Stanford Open Policing data set, where can this go outside of, you guys now have done the analysis of this, for members of the community, particularly activists who've been working around this, what can they do now with your analysis to effect some kind of change?
We haven't been in touch with anyone yet, but that's partly why we're on the radio. So if you're working on this project and you'd like to get in touch with us, you can join the Data for Democracy Slack group. Just search Data for Democracy and there will be instructions on how to join. And we're hanging out in a channel called City Boulder. But one other direction I'd like to take this, since this was all state police data, is I'd like to get local police data from Boulder City and from Denver especially, because there's not very much state police action in Denver proper. So our analysis of Denver mostly involved the county surrounding it, but the city itself might have very different policing patterns. Like an urban police force probably acts very differently than a state police force.
How widely available is that data to folks like yourself, just general members of the public, if they want to start their own local analysis looking at some of this data?
It's extremely available. You can download it on the internet if you are interested in taking a look at it for yourself and confirming that what we've already found. Then you're welcome to do that. You just find, Google Stanford Open Policing and the data set's available to anyone.
But if they're looking for data that's not part of that, mm-hmm. can you contact your local police department and demand that without some kind of lengthy FOIA application, Freedom of Information application?
Yeah, I think almost certainly it would involve that kind of application. You know, locally it's the CORA. We would have to submit a CORA request. Nationally, Stanford has managed to get data from 31 out of the 50 states because the laws are different state by state and the quality of the data has been different. I think...
For example, in Iowa, they released the data to Stanford. However, the data was not of sufficient quality and it was having to be thrown out because of irregularities and what have you.
We've had quite a few discussions here with journalists and other advocates for freedom of information who say that you also need to pay attention to how the data is made available, because if you're just handed a whole bunch of paperwork that's not properly classified, that's not properly indexed or whatever, it's incredibly difficult for folks like you then to dive into it. And there are ways that either police departments or city officials and people who gather this data can make it more accessible to members of the public. Is that an issue here in Colorado? Are we seeing not just accessibility in terms of, well, okay, here's the information, but how that information is presented with a view to then being able to dig into it? Are we doing an adequate job here in Colorado?
Yeah, nationally, my understanding, so I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that the departments are required to release the data in the format you request it, as long as it's available to them in that format. But locally, I'm not sure if there's the same requirement. The other day, I was trying to get the county commissioner emails to look into sort of the relationship of these like sort of Democratic establishment, you know, commissioners to the introduction of fracking to the area. And I found out that it would cost me over $1,000 because they're charging me $30 an hour to like read every email to make sure there's no lawyer or confidential information. And it would be released to me as like PDFs, which would be a huge pain to work with.
We're having conversations now about who should have access to what data in terms of the voter registration, and there's requests made to the Secretary of State. And so there's a lot of discussion now about who gets to have access to information, what is privacy, what is a breach of privacy, and what is beneficial for the public. And so it seems like this is something that's of the moment where we're talking about the data that's available. It sounds like there's more data available to people than maybe they're aware of, or that maybe people don't realise that you as an individual member of the community, as a citizen, that you can actually go out and actually request a lot of that. I mean, do you think that institutions and public officials need to do a better job of letting people know that, you know what, this is actually out there for anyone to get if you really want it?
Yeah, I was surprised when I found out that I could just request the emails and get them. I think there's definitely like a role that local media like KGNU could play in like letting people know exactly how to do Quora requests and like what you can expect, and like these are things that are out of bounds for them, and like because people in these agencies aren't always on top of the law either, you know, they'll like not out of bad intentions just mislead you, and so having like a journalistic base to like inform you is extremely helpful.
What are some of the projects? Well, actually, I wanted to ask you, in terms of personally, you're both volunteers for this. Are you coming from a background of data analysis or just with some type of interest? And I'm asking that with a view to if listeners would like to get involved in this, but maybe feel, you know, I'm not qualified in something specific like this. I mean, what kind of qualifications do you need, and what are you personally bringing to this? And why did you get involved?
So specifically, I have an academic background. So I have a solid background in math and statistics and analyzing results. But I know many people who come into this field not having much prior knowledge of either programming or math or stats, but just a interest and a motivation to learn more. And I think all you need is that sort of motivation and drive to explore the data that's out there and try to understand how our community is functioning and how well it's working.
And what about you, Sam? What background are you bringing to this, and why? And then, you know, for people who are listening, what skills are really good for this?
I have a background in computer science. And so what people say data science is nowadays is sort of this intersection of computer science, statistics, and domain knowledge. And so I'm definitely strongest on the computer side of that equation. The other members of our group tend to, so far at least, we have quite a few like PhD students, and like it definitely helps to have like more of a mathematical background when you're doing the actual statistics. But there's a lot of work around just sort of working with these websites, like downloading the forms from these cryptic government sites and like aggregating the data together, that I'd say like a healthy proportion of the total, like nationally, Data for Democracies people are people with a background in like web scraping or data visualization. And again, like Jeff said, I don't think you need a background in it before to take part in it. It just helps to like get started and to, you know, contribute.
It sounds like you also need some fundraising, because you mentioned here the fact that you were charged nearly, or would be charged almost $1,000 for an email request that you submitted to the county commissioners. And that's pretty common. And I know across the states, different states have different costs. Even though this is supposedly accessible to the public, there are different administrative costs in this. I mean, is it quite a costly endeavor, or is a lot of this available at no cost?
The data we've been looking at, for the most part, has been made to us for free. Because we have a good relationship with Julia at the city, she's been giving us city data for free, for example. But I could imagine that if we were like sort of like an antagonistic media group and like, you know, asking her for information through Quora requests, that it would cost money.
In terms of future projects, I mean, is it a virtual working group, or do you actually have meetups together where people could maybe come along and meet you in person? Or is this really, by the nature of the work that you're doing, more of a virtual space?
I'd say it's very decentralized, and we do spend quite a bit of our time together in our Slack channel. But we do try to meet up every once in a while, especially the local chapters. We meet up and meet face-to-face and talk about what is important to us and what we find most alarming, and which data we want to look at and projects we want to tackle.
Well, we'll talk a little bit just as we wrap up about future projects, but how time-consuming is all of this, you know, given that you're all volunteers?
Well, volunteers can contribute as much time as they like each week. I personally am only contributing maybe 10 or 12 hours of my time each week to this project.
Which is still a lot.
It's quite a bit, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And so it always feels like you're only making small baby steps towards the finish line. But yeah, members can come and contribute as much time as they are willing to give us. And each minute's well appreciated. Yeah.
And if anyone wants to pay me to do this, I would prefer that over volunteering my time any day. It's just one of these fields that, like you said, journalism is woefully underfunded, let alone people without any journalism background who are sort of just nibbling around the edges, particularly on a data side. But I think that's where collaborating with news groups could get us like more mileage than we otherwise would.
Given that Data for Democracy is relatively new, it just kind of formed in the advent of the Trump administration. Have you had any examples nationally where this organization has been able to dig into data and actually make some kind of change, or at least change the conversation somehow?
Yeah, I know that nationally there's a project on internal displacement of the team that was working on that project entered a contest for solving this issue of internal displacement by looking at data.
Is that internal displacement of people?
Yeah, exactly. Like people who are forced to move. They won a national contest, and they're presenting it to the UN, like, I think this week. There's been a lot of coverage around some of the work Data for Democracy nationally has been doing on the far right online, just because there's been a lot of interest in that in general.
And of course, we're now in the midst of a debate about healthcare, and so much of that is budget and numbers, and it seems crucial now more than ever that we have access to figures and facts, and people adhere to that during debates and during policy decisions. I suppose this kind of brings us back to where we started the conversation about the need to have proper data that's acknowledged and recognised by all sides of the political spectrum. But data and science and facts have been politicised. So where do you see all of this going? I mean, do you see the further politicisation of this data? I mean, it's hard to think that numbers and facts and science and things that are, you know, based in truth, it's politicized now, and you can have a debate over whether a number is true. It seems to now moved into the realm of subjectivity.
Yeah. Well, Trump's administration is so outrageously out there as far as like the scientific consensus goes, that my hope is that it will actually help. This is just a hope because I don't see any evidence of it. But my hope is it'll recenter the conversation on like what is actually science. Like, climate change is real. It's happening. It's human caused. And yet we have people in extreme positions of power who deny it. And that's always been the case, even before Trump. But now it's just these people who you otherwise would have expected to at least, you know, remain like tactfully neutral are, you know, coming out extremely anti-science. Well, part of the anti-fracking work that we're trying to do involves plotting the COGCC complaints on a map in a sort of like visually compelling way. This is like my personal like pet thing that I've been trying to get going, because complaints to the like when you get fracked, when your neighborhood gets a well in your like in your backyard pretty much, and you have noise pollution and you have weird issues with your drinking water and your house keeps shaking, what the officials will tell you to do is, we don't have much to do for you, but you can submit a complaint to the COGCC. And so far I haven't seen very many like journalistic exposés of this, but it seems like a lot of times the complaints just get referred to the operator. It's like, oh, your water's bad. We'll tell Crestone about it, and they'll look at it for you. And it's considered resolved.
Oh, okay. It's resolved, or possibly not even logged as an official complaint.
Yeah. It's all in the database as a complaint, but it's sort of like the narrative of what people are actually complaining about that's so powerful. Like hearing about people's like houses shaking like several times a day, they'll record the exact timestamps of when the tremors occurred, because they think that it'll like add to their case. And I just don't know where this data is going. And so I think publishing it and making it more like accessible would help drive the conversation around this.
Okay. So fracking, Jeff, do you have any particular areas you'd love to dig into?
I'm personally interested in just transparency at the local city council level, and what's being done in the city and what's being discussed at our meetings and how our representatives are best representing us, and making sure people know exactly what is being discussed and if the issues that they're most interested in and concerned about are being raised.
Well, if people are interested in finding out more about your work, particularly the local chapter, we'll put a link to the nationaldatafordemocracy.org chapter at our website. How can they best get in touch with you locally?
We can put a link to our local chapter's work as well.
We'll link to that. And we'll also put graphs of the work that you have done digging into the Stanford Open Policing Dataset and how it pertains to the Colorado State Patrol stops. In the meantime, Sam and Jeff, thank you very much.